Hello and welcome back to Kitchen Curiosity, the podcast that delves into the heart of food service equipment and the hospitality sector. I'm your host, Radford Chancellor. And today we're in Italy recording near Venice at the State of an Art Factory for Moreno, which is part of the Alley Group. I'm sat down with a number of guests, including the export manager for Moreno, executive chef for One Aldwych, and the director of Grand Cuisine UK, who is also the importer for Moreno for the UK market. Kitchen Curiosity is proudly sponsored by the Alley Group. Now, my first guest is executive chef at One Aldwych London, and he's flown out to be with us here today in Italy in person. As a young chef in the 90s, he started his culinary journey at the prestigious Lanesborough Hotel in London and also the Bishopstow House in Wiltshire. He had an experimental phase where he went worked in Asian cuisines in places like Hong Kong, and then he also went out to the Caribbean before he then returned to the Lanesborough Hotel. He's also worked for Marco Pierre White at the Oak Room and Escargot as sous chef, and then to head chef and executive chef, and he's also held at that time a Michelin star for six consecutive years before establishing himself at the One Aldwych in London. It's fantastic to have Dominic Teague with us today. Dominic, thank you for joining us in Italy and joining the show. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me, Rad. It's great to be here, and it's a treat to get out of London for a couple of days, I must say.
Well, I would say, you know, how was your flight? But as fate would have it, we were on the same flight, so.
Yeah, it was good, actually. Yeah, 2 hours is just a nice time to gin and tonic and a nap, and all good in the world.
Exactly. So you've clearly had quite a pretty colourful journey in the culinary world so far. So if we go back to the beginning, can you give us just a brief journey of your career to date?
Yeah, so obviously, I look back now, it's a long old time, right? But it's I went to catering college when I left school at 16, like most chefs of my era and a lot of my colleagues around town. You sort of leave school with not particularly great qualifications and think, what are you going to do with life? I'd been working in a pub washing up from sort of 13, 14 years old. I knew I enjoyed that environment and the warmth and the camaraderie and the sort of atmosphere of a kitchen. So went to catering college, 2 years full time, back in the days of sitting guilds 7 and 6, 1 and 2 and other bits and pieces. And then was told at college you need to go to London for a year to get on your CV. So I came to London in 1992 when the Lanesborough Hotel had just opened.
Yeah.
And to get a year on my CV, and I'm still here like 33 years later, still going. So, but I've been very, very lucky. But that key sort of appointment or that key position, if you like, at that time really moulded who I sort of became, because thrown right in the deep end at Lanesborough 1992, and I ended up staying, I think, 7 years in total and loved it.
And you've done all around the world, really, haven't you?
Yeah.
Caribbean,
so,
I understand.
Yeah. So 7 years at Lanesborough. I went to Hong Kong for nearly a year at that time as well in the 90s. Right. That was a great experience. Love that. I worked in San Delaney, Barbados, my previous job before where I am at the moment, at One Aldwych for two and a half years, which again, incredible experience. And the rest of the time has been in London. So, you know, I always say to youngsters that the opportunities we have is incredible, and they just, the world is out there to, and if you can cook,
world's your oyster,
so to speak. Yeah. If you can cook, you've got options to travel as well, which is great.
So Dominic, can you tell the listeners a bit about your role as executive chef at One Aldwych, sort of the type of food, your team, and you know how you bring creativity to the menu?
Yeah, so One Aldwych, we have two restaurants, two very different offerings. So we have Indigo Restaurant, which is the sort of breakfast, lunch and dinner offering.
Okay.
We like to keep it as a focus on seasonality, great produce, cook relatively simply, but we just focus on the produce. It's very, you know, relaxed, in formal, but still done in a, you know, in an elegant setting, in a beautiful setting. But we, you know, we keep it unstuffy on purpose. You know, we can have busy pre-theatres because of our location. So that needs to be considered. We could have people coming off a long flight. They just literally want a, you know, a great steak and a glass of wine. So we have that offering there as well. Pick lots of celebrations, especially at weekends. So we'd have a tasting menu that they can come and have a bit of a blowout. So we sort of cover those bases, but it's all comes down to predominantly British food, British head ingredients, you know, obviously super sustainable and great local farms and all that sort of stuff, which I've done for years anyway. Of course, everyone's doing it a lot now, but we've always been that led like that anyway. Yeah, yeah, we've always been like that. And then to add on to that, the restaurant is gluten and dairy free as well, which I did about 8-9 years ago.
Right.
And that was a big change in the customers, what they were ordering and the change in the allergens becoming much more prominent. And I think at that time,
do you actually market that as a gluten, or is this just
we subtly do? Yeah, I don't. I was very keen not to really make it seem that it was just a sort of a trend or a fad, because it's not. We generally do, you know, great food, great produce. It just happens to be gluten dairy free, because I passionately believe that you can still have a great meal if there's no gluten in it. It's just about adapting recipes and getting the team on board and creating that culture, which is what we've done over time.
It's quite unique. I don't think there's much in London doing
there's,
that.
There's nobody at our sort of level. There's also a couple of little restaurants and cafes and stuff. But we are unique in the luxury market to do that. And I think probably, you know, a few people would raise a few eyebrows when we first started doing that, and probably a few of my friends were thinking I was crazy. But on the back of that, it's almost we had it. For example, Christmas, we had a family came in, took a 3-bedroom suite for a lot of money. And when I was speaking to them on Christmas Day, it was like, you know, well, how come you chose Norwich, and you know, why did you choose us? And they said, oh well, I'm a celiac, I know your restaurant's gluten free, so it's perfect for us. So on the back of the restaurant doing that within the hotel, we've also gained, you know, a huge revenue for the rooms as well. And that happens quite a lot. So, and we weren't really expecting that. That was, you know, and I have people, predominantly when we did it, it was the lunch and dinner menu was the gluten-free offering. But of course, we service breakfast as well for the hotel, which is, we do an a la carte, and it's, you know, great products. And again, produce is great. You know, we spend good money on all the basics, eggs and sausages. We know we don't cut any corners. But we were getting external guests coming in for breakfast that had heard that the dinner was gluten free, and then everyone's come for breakfast. And I was like, I never set it up for breakfast. I need to know. I've got to rethink that.
So yeah.
But we don't have that exclusively, because.
The afternoon teas, which.
And then we have afternoon tea. The famous Charlie, inspired by China Chocolate Factory afternoon tea. So that's been a massive success. You know, when we first started doing that, I think we've got to go back again at 8-9 years maybe now. We were asked to, I was asked to come up with something, because the show was coming around the corner, directed by Sam Mendes. And we said, yeah, we can have a bit of fun with that. We can do a nice afternoon tea. So I went and read the book again by Roald Dahl and got some inspiration from some of the key words in it. And at the time, the tea we were doing at that time was, if we had 10 covers on a Saturday, it was like, oh, hell break loose, you know, somebody make me a sandwich, and somebody's going to make the scones. You know, it wasn't really a thing we did. And now we can do, you know, 160, 180 a day in certain times of the year. You know, we do. And I've created, we have a whole new dedicated team for it now, separate kitchen, separate entrance, separate restaurant, just for afternoon tea. Yeah, and it's great. And it just, you know, it just, and it's actually, it's, you know, we talk about, I don't want to go off on a tangent too much on this for the whole staffing shortage or whatever, but it does allow us to, people come to me for a role, and it allows us to be a bit flexible in what we offer them, because some people, it might just suit. I just want to make sandwiches, you know, between 9 and 4. I've got a pick
me up. Daytime work.
Yeah, I've got a pick me up from school. I need to leave early. You can create that role for them there, whereas other ones want to do more restaurant, more serious stuff, you know, more of the elegant, the tasting menus. Okay, come upstairs. You can, you know, do dinners for the restaurant. So by having those two options, it also helps with recruitment in some ways, because you've got options to offer they come in, for shift patterns and stuff. Okay. So that's quite a big help as well. But the tea's a big one, particularly, and obviously very well known for it. But it's almost the reputation we've got from the allergens is now sort of almost merged down to the afternoon tea as well now, which can get quite challenging because, you know, my poor head chef down there, when he gets the booking sheet before service, does the briefing, and you're like, you know, somebody wants to come in with a kid for tea and this list of allergens, and you're like, there's 15 elements on the tea. So it's not like upstairs at the restaurant where someone chooses a lamb with, you know, braised shoulder and morels. You can adapt that, you can sort of tweak that. But if they've got pre-made, and obviously for tea, everything's pre-made. So
yeah, it's difficult to adapt it.
So it keeps on our toes anyway.
Thank you for that. So the Lanesborough, I mean, it's got a walk in the park, really, and it's one of the most expensive prestigious hotels in London.
Yeah.
Do you got any interesting recollections or anything you can share from your time at the Leyland Spring?
That's a whole separate podcast. I think we could fill hours talking about some of those stories. But yeah, but there was many. I mean, we had fun there. I mean, it was just a great to be part of that team, and I'm still very good friends with lots of the colleagues that were there at that time. But many stories, probably some of them I probably couldn't share on a family show. I think I have to be a bit careful what I'd speak about, but there was some great stories. But I remember once when I was particularly young, I hadn't been there very long, and we were quite forward thinking at the time, is we used to have lots of guest chefs come over, which is now it's quite common, you know, guest chef dinners and collaborations and stuff. But at the time it wasn't really happening that much around town.
Right.
And we used to get some big names coming in. We had Charlie Trotter came over when he was at the height of his powers for a week and others. But we had Roger Verger mm-hmm. who came over. And he was at the time was, you know, I think it was the end of his career. He was quite an old man, but he sent his team over in advance. And I was a youngster on one of the garnish sections, and I remember I had one dish to do all week. So I think he sent his head chef and a couple of sous chefs with him, and he came over on the last day. And all week we'd been doing this dish, and my only dish that I had to concentrate on was a stuffed courgette flower,
right,
filled with a whole truffle,
cool,
and duck cell. And Lisa used to steam it to order. The juice would all drop out. You reduce the juice down, whisk in a little bit of cream, loads of butter, and literally that was it on the plate. Just beautiful, elegant, you know, the provincial, just summed up his cooking, and just stunning dish. But at the time, Mr. Gaylor, who's, you know, a good friend of mine and my mentor, executive chef there for 21 years, he was notorious, for being keeping a very close eye on the food costs, shall I say. So okay. We were doing lots of covers of this, because obviously Roger Verger is an iconic chef of anyone's era, but you know, it was a big name to have in town, packed every lunch, every dinner. And after a couple of days of this, I got the nod from the sous chef to say, Dominic, cut the truffles in half, there's too many truffles, cut them in half. So I was only a commie, yeah, no problem. Another day goes by, Dominic, there's too much truffle, bit smaller. Right, yeah, I'm just a commie, yeah, no problem, chef. And on the last day, he turned up to sort of be part of it, but he just sort of stood and watched service. And he was this iconic figure in the kitchen watching us work and didn't speak a word of English. And of course, the dish that he grabs to have a look at going out was
yours.
Was the courgette flour with about an eighth of a truffle inside it, and get very animated in French and gesturing towards me. And I was sort of a young commie, not knowing really what to do, but I learned. And I think that's probably why Mr. Gaylor is probably still good friends with me now. And he respects me, because I just took one for the team, and no problem.
Yeah, it wasn't actually your
fault. What's happened there? I'll sort that out. And proceeding to then sort of quickly.
But obviously, you kept your job. You were still there.
Yeah, yeah.
Throwing out with the bins.
But it was a little bit, you know, everyone was sort of looking at me. But I kept them and just, you know, replaced it with some more truffles. But it was yeah, but that was quite iconic. And then I've had, several other stories. Speaking to Pam Randerson on Christmas Day was a big one. Yeah, that was a fun one. So Chef used to... His thing was, he used to carve the turkey on the 24th at lunch, at like 2-3 o'clock.
Yeah.
And then go home for Christmas, and then the sous chefs would run Christmas. So there was, I think at this time, this is later in the 90s, I was a junior sous chef. My old friend of mine, Justin, was the senior sous, and we used to run Christmas basically. And the chef called us in the office in the morning and said, Dominic, I want you to send up to the Royal Suite. There's Tommy Lee. I can't remember his surname, Tommy Lee. What's his name? John? He was just married to Pam Anderson at the time.
Okay,
very famous couple. And they were staying in the Royal Suite. So Pam Anderson in the 90s, this iconic lady, and her husband was very well known as well. Chef calls us in, send up some canopies to the suite, Royal Suite, from the Christmas morning. And I've just put a card in it. You know, and the card said, you know, thank you, for staying. Enjoy your Christmas, Paul Gaylor.
Mm.
He said, put that card on the canopy, send him up. Yeah, no problem, chef. So shake his hand, off he goes. Then Christmas morning comes along, we're cooking away, basting the turkeys, roasting, you know, doing all the potatoes, all that sort of stuff. It's a crazy busy day. Justin says to me, come on, Tiggy, we get these canopies up for the Royal Suite, make all these beautiful canopies, call the butler to take them up. And at the last minute, Justin says, takes the card off, throws it to one side and says, just tell them that's compliments of Justin and Dominic in the kitchen and have a great Christmas. So he sends it up.
Yeah.
About an hour later, we're all running around and one of the phone goes in the larder and there's a young lad walks through and goes, Justin, Dominic, it's a phone call for you. And I, you know, normal response. Well, we're busy, tend to, you know, during get service. Lost, whatever. Oh, it's Tommy Lee and Pamela Anderson on the phone. We just drop everything, go running through, and they were on the phone saying, oh, geez, thanks very much. You know, that's awesome. Thanks for sending those up. Have a great Christmas. And we were like, yeah, no problem, no problem. Just get the straight face. And then and Chef got back. How did it go, Christmas boys? Yeah, all good, Chef, no problem. Canopies go up all right? Yeah, all good, all good. Never told him. Never told him we got the phone call.
So, I mean, a Michelin star, it's what every chef, I guess, kind of aspires to and wants. I understand you held one for 6 consecutive years. How do you maintain that? How do you...
Yeah, I mean, that was at Lascargo, obviously another iconic restaurant, and I started there as sous chef and then progressed through, so I was part of the team. Obviously, there's lots of other people involved in that, but I think Michelin are there's no secret about it. It's about consistency.
Right.
And they always maintain that. It's about being consistent. And that's right from the bread, the butter, to the petit four, it's the whole meal. It's not, you know, you can't have an average starter and an amazing main course. That, you know, it has to be consistent all through every process of the meal. And it's just about the consistency. And then that has to come from, you know, trusting your team, employing the right people, you know, great suppliers, great produce, great front of house, that it's all connected together. Ultimately, I think it's about the consistency, is maintaining it for that long.
And keeping it, yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of hard work tied into that and all the other things that go with it, but it's the consistency of the food at that level.
So, I mean, I'm sure you've had many mentors that you've had probably through your career. Is there any advice that you would give to a chef in our sector?
Well, I'd say to the young ones coming through, because obviously we have plenty of youngsters coming through at One Orbitch. It really is just about being keen, being enthusiastic. Yes, you need to work hard, but that doesn't mean you've got to work 15 hours a day anymore. Those days have gone.
Right.
But when you're there, get your head down and work and concentrate. You know, be on time, be respectful, work clean and tidy, and ask lots of questions. And it's literally as simple as that, I think, when you're starting out. Because if you do those, and I say to my youngsters all the time, if you just do those things, you will be better than 95% of the people as you progress, because they come in late as a norm, or they're a dirty cloth, or their station's a mess. If you can just
do the basics,
almost be like military in your presentation of yourself in your workstation, and you know, respectful to people, and ask questions, you will naturally progress, because the opportunities are there in our industry. So there's no real secret behind it. It's just, you know, be inquisitive, you know, and give everything, because the quicker you develop, the quicker you learn, and the higher up you can go, and
better skills become, and so on.
It's just so it's, forth. Yeah, it's not. It's not rocket science. People, I think, overcomplicate it sometimes. They try to run before they can walk, which is a big problem. I think they need to just slow down a bit. And this whole thing of, you know, chef de parties at 19, 20 and stuff, it needs to just stop. Everyone needs to just... I get why... of course, I understand that, you know, living is expensive and they want more money, and I get all that. But I always try and say that if you can just almost forget that until you're 30...
Yeah,
I know it's difficult. You know, I get that there's a living crisis, cost of living crisis. I understand all that. Of course I do. But also, if you can somehow just get to 30 without focusing on that part of it, just focus on your craft and the skills and your trade. 30 to 60 is a long time to work before you retire, or 65 or 70 by the time we get there or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a long time. And then you will benefit, because you will be earning more money because you've done more in your 20s.
Of course. Yeah.
And I'm a firm believer in that. And I was always told that as well when I was very young. I remember at the Lanes when I started, Chris Galvin was the executive sous chef. And I remember him telling me that when I was young. He said, you learn your craft when you're young. You've got to learn your craft, and the rest will come.
As you progress through your career.
But I always think, and then you get to our age now, I generally think, I've still got another years to go before I retire. And you think it's a long time to work. So if the more you can do then, you will reap the rewards when you're 30 to 70, perhaps. That's a long time to... Then you've got the chance to earn better money and better choices and choose which job you want, not have to take one because you've not skill enough or not knowledgeable enough.
Yeah, of
that's
course,
the key
of course.
As well.
So a couple of light-hearted questions now, which two have been submitted by the listeners. Can you remember what the first dish was that you ever cooked? And was it a success or was it a disaster?
Well, I remember when I was very young making the apple crumble on a Sunday with my dad, who was always a very good, keen home cook. And that was always a thing, making the crumble mix on top. That was one of my first memories of sort of, you know, hands in flour and rubbing in flour and butter and stuff. And I remember my second day at college, when we took Cajun College. Day one was the induction. You get your knives in your uniform. It's all very exciting. And, you know, you're walking around with a chef's jacket on. And day two was a three-hour lesson making, I think, one pint of mayonnaise, literally. But I remember the Wednesday. I remember the first day in the hot kitchen was petit pois le français.
Right, okay.
And it was the old school way of making it, I think, with the stock, and it was, you know, the onion and the pancetta, the peas, and you braise it in the oven.
That was like day three.
Yeah. And so nowadays, of course, if it's a more modern way of doing it, if we do something like that, you'll do probably a pea puree to sort of bind it all and thicken it, and then you finish it with, julienne of lettuce at the end, and just nice and fresh, and there's baby onions in there and pancetta. And but those days it was a bit more old school, and it was done in stock, so you'd thicken it at the end with a beurre manier as it came out, but it was braised in the oven.
Right.
And I just remember day three, very early on, learning the importance of always use a cloth when you take out something out of the oven at 180 degrees, because I just put my thumb straight on the handle at 180 degrees for 40 minutes, and this massive blister on my thumb. Getting home, and my mum just going, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I was just like, sorry. "And like, yeah." So petit pois le français, first hot dish I remember making.
Was it nice? Were you happy with it?
It was actually really. I remember it being really salty.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We used to cook, and we used to take stuff home. You take it home in the old Chinese takeaway containers, and I remember sort of going home proud as punch. I'd made something at college on my third day, and my mum was sort of doing dinner for the family, and I remember, bless my mum and my dear stepdad, eating it and not sort of saying anything. "Oh, it's lovely, Dominic, lovely, lovely." And even I, at my untrained palate at the time, was grabbing like glasses of water because it was so salty. Because I think obviously that maybe
we've all had those moments where someone's brought something home and you're like, "What is that?"
Yeah.
Trying to recognise what it looks like.
Exactly.
So you're stuck on a desert island. What's the four ingredients that you would really want to utilise, and what would you use them for?
Ingredients. Well, I think if I'm stuck in a desert island, I'm probably craving some...
You can go with beer if you want. I mean,
I think the hunger would probably be getting to me, because I get a bit stroppy when I get hungry. So I think I'd probably just keep it, I don't know, something like a, you know, beautiful burger, brioche buns, and I don't know, some beautiful mayonnaise and some caramelised onion, and just have a dirty burger. I think I'll be craving that.
But I wonder if, like, by day 20, that might be getting a bit.
I don't know. Maybe. Maybe I could mix it up.
That sounds like a really good practical choice, because, you know. Okay, so sort of finish off this section. It's a bit of a quick fire round, some short, kind of snappy answers, if you like.
Yeah.
So, butter or oil?
Butter.
Okay. Sweet or savoury?
That's close, actually, but I'd go sweet. Yeah.
Fine dining or street food?
Street food.
Okay. Cookbooks or YouTube?
I'm old school, it's cookbooks.
Okay. Freestyling or set recipes?
Probably a bit controversial in my position at One Orwich and looking after my team and always bashing them about recipes, but I think by nature I'm a bit of a freestyler.
Okay.
Yeah.
And fresh herbs or spices?
Fresh herbs. Love fresh herbs.
So why did you go butter or oil? What's the sort of thing there?
Well, it's strange, again, because obviously at One Orchard at the moment, I'm not sure if you're aware, but our restaurant is gluten and dairy free.
Oh,
so we don't actually use butter in the restaurant.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. So I've had to adapt everything that we're doing to you know, with flavoured oils and sort of marinades and stuff. And it's actually been great to go through that process. But sort of historically, my age and my background is a bit more old school and a bit more sort of French classical. My time at the Scargo, especially.
Yeah.
So lots of butter was used. So I think if I was probably cooking at home, I'd probably load up with the butter, definitely.
Okay.
But professionally, we are using less and less, and especially at One Ullwich and Indigo, we don't use any. So,
well, Dominic, thank you for that, for the insight, obviously, into One Ullwich and sort of your career and some of the fun questions. We're just going to take a short break now, and then I'm going to be joined by the export area manager for Moreno, the factory that we're in today. And then, Dominic, you're going to join us for a group chat with Steve and Monica.
Okay, great. Sounds good.
Welcome to the world of Ali, the largest and most diverse food service equipment company on the planet. With over 110 brands under the Ali Group umbrella, we serve more than 150 countries worldwide. Our brands are at the forefront of innovation, offering cutting-edge technology and ergonomic designs that keep pace with the ever-evolving market. But we're not just a global leader, we're a network of local companies working together to deliver excellence. Ali Group's unmatched expertise in food service makes us the proud exclusive sponsor of Kitchen Curiosity. To learn more, visit aligroup.com.
So now I'm joined by the export area manager from Moreno, someone that I've known for many years and someone that I actually hold in high regard in our sector. Monica Arato, she is experienced export manager, demonstrated history in working in the food service equipment sector with an undoubtedly proven skill in negotiation, international sales, culture, business development and export. And someone that I would say is probably one of the most kindest people in our sector. So Monica, thank you for inviting us to your factory.
Thank you for being here, Radford. Really, it's our pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. We've been honestly actually looked after like kings and queens, if you
because
like.
Because you deserve it. Because you deserve it.
Yeah, honestly, it's beautiful. And thank you for the factory tour.
Welcome.
Because I think last time I was here was about,
I think, over 10 years ago.
12 years ago, and things have changed.
And did you see the difference?
Massive.
Yeah.
Massive difference. So
I can see it myself, to be honest with you, yeah.
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 Absolutely. Well, we'll get into that. So so for the listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your journey into food service equipment? And obviously I know bits, but for the listeners. And then, give us a short discussion about the Moreno factory.
Yes. I think I can say I am the personification of what John Lennon used to say, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. Really.
I love that.
When I was a child, I used to live very close to one of the Moreno factories.
Oh, seriously?
So, I had the logo always in front of my eyes. I used to see stainless steel sheets every day. And I started saying, well, in my future, everything but stainless steel. Everything but stainless steel. I was sure about that. I was very keen on foreign languages, of course. I wanted to learn foreign languages.
How many languages do you speak?
Well, German in first instance. I've been studying and living in Germany as well. And then English, some little bit of French, Spanish, but really little bit.
Wow.
I've been studying some
Don't ask me how many languages I speak.
Well, but you speak English very well.
So, go on.
I wanted just to get into a different world, and I knew I wanted to travel the world, for sure. Fact is that after university, well, I was working never here in the area. I'm originally from this area, but I left with 18 and I just came back. I was working in Milan that time. I had to come back for family reason. I did an interview here in Moreno. I liked the people very much, but I said I'm staying here for 6 months.
Right.
And that was April 2001.
Okay.
Yes.
And then you got into...
I got into the business and I realized I really like the business.
So you agreed to stay for 6 months and here we are. Yeah. How many years later?
24 years in April.
So that worked.
Yes, it's working quite well. But this is because I had the chance, of course, inside the company to see different changes, developments. I had a very good mentor, which was Michele Romano, which you know, of course, very much. And
shout out for Michele there.
We were just the two of us taking care of export that time. Export for Moreno before used to be just production for other brands, so yeah. OEM. Mm-hmm. And Marino little by little started actually looking into other markets, but for our own brand, building an image and yes, a reputation for the Marino brands. And if you look into the, well, if you see the payoff of Marino, it's complete kitchens since 1922.
Yeah.
Which means complete projects, turnkey projects. So little by little, I've learned a lot, to be honest with you. And I've learned from customers, from the markets, from their questions or doubts. I've learned a lot and I liked it.
Mm. So, I mean, obviously, we're here at the factory.
Yeah.
In Italy, obviously. So, give us a bit of information about the factory. I mean, you're making everything here. I mean, obviously, we went on around and saw it all.
We do pretty everything here, which means as far as stainless steel is concerned, we work stainless steel sheets, of course. Cutting, bending, welding is done here. The only thing which is outsourced is pressing.
Right, okay.
And there is a lot of pressing, of course, because of...
For things like deep fat fryers and things like that for people. Yeah.
Okay. Or the gas hobs, for example. So rounded corner. The principle is that of rounded corners for ease of cleaning. Yeah. The H2 cabinets are also done inside here. So first part of production is, of course, production of stainless steel components and then the assembly lines. Assembly lines, there are several actually. Mm-hmm. I think we've got altogether 18,000 square meter between the two production sites.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Okay. But 70% of the production is, of course, cooking appliances, modular cooking appliances. Mm-hmm. And the rest is fabrication, self-service, and more special construction is getting important.
So bespoke suites.
Yes, bespoke suites,
like.
Monoblocks. Even bespoke fabrication to get along with a cooking block or with a monoblock, just to create a family feeling
so
inside
sort of profile,
the kitchen.
It looks the same.
Exactly.
I guess if it's in a theatre or something, like a open kitchen, that's important.
Yes.
People want to see that.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing that struck me going around the factory is that quality control aspect.
Yeah.
That it's right there, like every employee can quality control. Is that correct?
Exactly. Every employer has the right to stop any piece of equipment or any single component just to make quality control aware of a scratch of a component not working properly, which sometimes is also delaying delivery time. It's very unpleasant when it happens, but it's necessary.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things of which I've been seeing growing in this company, organization and attention for details and for quality control.
Okay. So you're export area manager. Yeah. I know you've got quite a big area.
Yeah.
Europe and...
Well, all German-speaking countries where I started actually from. And then Northern Europe from Austria up to Iceland. Eastern Europe, I stopped actually at the Russian border. Mm-hmm. And then I recently picked up also Far East and Australia.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Would you see a difference in the products that are being purchased across... the regions or?
Well, there are some specific products for some specific markets, but I would say there is a general trend all over, which is affecting also, which I can see also in the domestic market and in all markets which were traditional gas driven markets to switch to electric.
Okay.
Everybody would like, even Asia. Australia, very much. They do commitment, actually, to switch from gas to electric.
You're seeing that across the world, really?
Yeah, everywhere. The problem is the infrastructure, which is not always there.
Yeah.
I remember 20 years ago, the fast-moving item, the most sold item was the six-burner range. Now it's induction.
Okay. So for people that don't know Marino, I know we've touched on this, but could you describe what is Marino? What do you do, for just...
Yeah.
People just listening don't maybe know.
We can say different things. Marino is known as a manufacturer for modular cooking equipment.
Okay. Predominantly horizontal.
Horizontal cooking, yes, yeah. Horizontal cooking. Then if you look at our catalog, of course, it's quite thick. We've got over 18,000 standard codes.
Yeah.
Inside there, which is cooking equipment, fabrication. We've got everything what is needed in the kitchen from the floor galley up to the GN containers, so to say, going through ovens, plus chillers and so on. But there is still a wide opportunity to improve quality of every single items, every single lineup or monoblock with small features. Marino is, I think, a great craftsmanship.
Okay.
With attention more and more to developments on the market, the possibility of having monoblocks, and also customizing the cooking block according to the customer needs.
Yeah.
And with even with colors, with dedicated print on the cooking block. Marino in general, I think, is value for money.
Yeah.
And especially with the new M1 series, is attention for details, cleanings, hygiene. Think yeah. of the worktop, which you have seen today with the front and rear rim to protect actually the control panel. The idea is to protect the control panel from anything dripping out of the working surface. Working surface, we know, well, chefs need to work there. It's their play field there, but yep. they are sometimes even hectic. Many things happen on the worktop,
on the stove,
but
yeah.
yeah, on the surface does not, and we want to protect the components itself.
Of course.
I would say that, and having said that, we improved, for example, the connections between the appliances with protection, the seal protection underneath the worktop. There are some, starting from an entry-level product, I think the chef here is really the protagonist. He can pick whatever he wants. Huge offer of gas and electrical functions, and also a huge variety of accessories rather than upgrade. If you think standard cabinets or H2,
yeah.
soft closing drawers rather than self-closing door with a return spring, all small things which can be, of course, applied for those who want to upgrade their kitchen. But the kitchen must be, first of all, not only the playground of a chef, but it's where they generate their revenue, actually.
Of course, of course. So, yeah. And that's coming on to, you know, if you're talking to a chef, and I know you're obviously mainly talking to your distributors and things like that, but if people are talking to a chef
yeah.
or your partner's or a chef, why should a chef buy Marino?
For part of the reason, well, first of all, it is value for money, I would say. Even if the case outside, so to say, offers different opportunities, quality level and details level, mm-hmm. what is important is the technical side, the components and the function itself. That is always actually granted, developed in a way that, to grant consistency, of course, and robust. Reliable, and if something happens, of course, any single component can be easily replaced.
Yeah.
These in order to reuse, replace, the 3R, which are more and more important, of course, and recycle, sorry.
Of course.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, just picking up on that, I was yeah. amazed to hear that 92% of your stainless steel is actually recycled.
Yes. Yes, so yes.
Pretty green.
It's an important part, of course, in production of stainless steel because it makes stainless steel more robust if it has got some material which has already been processed and produced. Yeah.
So, forgive the stereotype. Yeah. You're Italian, obviously.
Yes.
We're in Italy and the accent gives it away.
Yeah.
Italians love to cook.
Yeah.
Do you cook at home? What's your kind of go-to dish to cook at home, would you say?
Oh, yes, I do cook at home. I like cooking, and more, I would say, I control also the ingredients that I use. I love risotto, for example.
Okay.
My favorite food is risotto. yesterday evening you asked for pasta. Otherwise, I would have suggested risotto.
Oh, sorry. Sure.
No, no problem at all. No problem
I'm blaming Steve for that as well.
No, because you can do risotto actually with any fresh herbs, with simple ingredients. You can make it with fish. Our food culture here in the region is very traditional and seasonal, which means we can actually pick every vegetable, even fruit, which we have in season, which is fresh in season. And there are even very old recipes. I remember when I was a child, my grandma used to do risotto with nettles. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Even nettles, once boiled, they are not, they are very savory. And that's a traditional food, which you can do really risotto with everything, even with strawberries.
Yeah. Well, next time we're over, we're going to have risotto, I think.
Okay, fine, yes.
So just to wrap us up briefly, is there a project that you're particularly proud of? I know you do projects all over the world, but is there anything that sort of stands out or that you're working on at the moment?
There are quite a few, actually. I like, of course, the projects where it's where cooking is there, the cooking block, the cooking part, as well as fabrications, as service and so on. There was one which we have done over 10 years ago in the UK. I would say even more than 15 years ago.
Okay.
Because it was the first one ever. It was an hotel down in Dorset, which was paying particular attention to environmental issues. Okay. They were the first one to go for induction. Mm-hmm. And they've got a full system built around recycling water, sustainable production of food, local food, and so on. That was really interesting, actually.
We're talking 15 years ago.
Over 15 years ago, and it was quite early, Nowadays, we did a nice project in Poland, which is a Raffles Hotel.
Okay, beautiful.
Where I learned how much stainless steel can be also combined with different materials, with wooden top.
Okay.
Or marble top. The cooking block was actually all digital, electric and digital control. Mm-hmm. One piece top, a monoblock, very nice. And the rest around fabrication, for example, was all customized with wooden top rather than marble. And the final result was really appealing, I need to say. Yeah. And then, of course, I think with the latest development in the UK market, we approached more and more also interesting customers, nice restaurants.
Exactly.
I'm still learning a lot, I need to say. Yeah, really.
Even 25 or years on.
Yeah.
Well, Monica, thank you for that. Thank you for
your
insight into your career.
Thank you very much.
And obviously, thank you for hosting us. So we're now going to go on to the last part of the podcast, where Dominic's going to rejoin us. And we're also now joined by Steve Hobbs. So Dominic now rejoins us with Monica. And we're now also joined by Steve Hobbs, who's the director of Grand Cuisine in the UK. Steve, welcome back to the show. You're a veteran of Kitchen Curiosity. So people who listen to the podcast know that you're on season one. So just for people who maybe just joined us or haven't listened to that particular podcast, give us a very short intro into you and your business.
Okay. Well, firstly, Rad, thank you very much. I can't believe I'm referred to as a veteran. That's amazing. Thank you. Steve Hobbs, Grand Cuisine. We are the UK partners for Moreno. Also for another manufacturer based in France. I've been partnered with Moreno now for 7-8 years or so. And I have to say, when I first came to see the product 8 or 9 years ago, I wasn't quite sure whether it was for us and our business. But having worked with the organization over the last sort of 7 or 8 years, been absolutely amazing. And I have to say, Monica is just the oracle of Moreno. She is the go-to source of information, and we couldn't achieve what we do in the UK without her support.
Fantastic. Well, so welcome back. It's good to see you again. So we've just done a whirlwind tour of the factory, the two sites. So we saw sort of production and then some of the bespoke stuff. From my perspective, it's moved on a lot since last time I was here. I was really impressed by how organized, structured, sort of just-in-time production, that kind of thing, and also the quality control. Dominic, what was your kind of, is your first time here at the factory?
It is, yeah. Yeah, and it's, I have to say, it's not the normal sort of chefy trip, is it? Often, you know, we go and we get out and see farms and look at, you know, beef and chickens running around. So it's great to see this at the side of it, because it's obviously, it's a massive part of being your a chef is the equipment we're using, right? So it's great to get insight. And likewise, as you said, Rad, it's the you know, the organisation and the setup and the systems in place and the, and just the you see the sort of passion coming through from the whole company to get that product. It's incredible to look at it. It really is. It's great. It's a real eye opener. And it's really I always have this thing of, like, you know, with a team, if, you know, you've got to respect the product, the produce. You know, you don't overcook that scallop because someone's gone and dived and got that for you in freezing cold weather. And it's the same with the equipment, what you're cooking on. You've got to respect what you're working on. And when you come and see what's going on behind the scenes, it just magnifies that 10 times or 1,000 times. You know, you've seen what goes into making it. They've got
and the care.
And the care. And the yeah, yeah. So yeah, it's great detail. To see it. Great to see it, yeah.
So, Steve, you're the UK importer for this product. What, I mean, I know you've been here many times, but what's your thoughts on the factory?
So, but for me, I look back at the journey that I've had with the product, and I'm going to say this sort of quite flippantly, and now I get a punch on the arm from Monica at the end of this, but I'd be rude. So I'd grown up in a manufacturing world of that everything came out of Northern Europe and was therefore much better levels of specification than stuff produced in Southern Europe. But when I first came to the factory, within an hour of being here, I completely understood why the product was where it was, the level of technology within it, the level of pricing of it. And a lot of it comes down to the level of automation within the factory. I think, as we've all seen today, you certainly know Rad and I know Dominic, just the level of automation within the factory is what hit home to me. And therefore, because of that level of automation, the level of quality control, literally right the way from the basic sheet through to the final product. You know, that's what just hit home to me. And I'd encourage anybody to come and see it just as an eye opener, because, you know, to see a facility that can run 24 hours a day, in essence, 365 days a year, with very minimal human interaction at the start of the process is just incredible. And I'd like to think that you've seen that over the years since you were last here.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot more automation, and I can see there's new machines in the factory, and yeah, investment going on. I mean, Monica, what would you say are the sort of key stages of manufacturing for a product like Moreno here at the factory?
Well, if we're talking about standard products, since industrial production means as many pieces as possible and as much standard as possible, is planning. Planning is absolutely number one issue. Okay. Proper planning of production. And I don't actually oversee that much. The complete system is working. What I like to supervise myself is when it comes to special constructions and monoblocks, for example, to be sure that everything is done according to the customer wish. And also because I learned something more about the product, what is feasible, what is not feasible. And I think if you want to sell a product, you need to know it and know exactly how it is built and what is behind, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think the factory workers, they like those sort of more bespoke items, or do you think it doesn't really matter?
Let me say that there is a team, a very good team, which is passionate about designing, developing also special constructions, yes.
Okay.
On the other hand, the team supervising industrial production is really, first of all, is a long-term cooperation. They have been working here for a long, long time. They know every screw by name and surname. And they know, of course, how they develop during the year. And they are passionate about their job.
Dominic, I know you been using Grand Cuisine as a supplier for horizontal cooking in your hotel in London. How important is sort of consistency and quality of cooking equipment for you when you're looking at purchasing equipment and options?
It's absolutely paramount. It's absolutely key from a purely selfish chefy point of view. It's absolutely key. I mean, that, you know, it's an outlay. It's money. It's you know, it's when you're looking at the outlay to design a kitchen, that the main stove is a big chunk of that. But it's absolutely key to have that equipment you can trust. That's the thing. And it's I think I look back from years gone by to what we used to rattle pans on, some of the stoves we used to work on and stuff. And now you look at what most kitchens now, not most kitchens, but I'd say a good chunk of kitchens now will invest in the kitchen, whereas before it was all in the front of house and the kitchen was always an afterthought. That's now shifted obviously massively. So it you know, the money is spent, but it's absolutely key to get that right, to get the right item and to get the right product and the right supplier. Yeah. And it doesn't mean you have to go to the most expensive or whatever. Of course, it's not saying that, but just the right fit for your environment and your kitchen.
Yeah.
Absolutely key.
And the trust of having the service.
And if I may say something about this, I agree, of course, with you 100%, and something which I've been learning also from Steve. Our philosophy has always been to put that the chef is the protagonist, and the same is also for Steve. Steve is talking to the customer, understanding what he really needs, because you know that appliances can perform, of course, much more than what they are. Like they are sometimes, well, there are newest development which are like computers, but you only use actually part of it. And Steve is very focused on what the chef is needed. The chef is the protagonist. Of course, he is the one using the appliance for his own art and also to generate his own revenue.
It's interesting what Dom said about, you know, it is the heart of the kitchen or whatever. My thing has always been about the stove, is that what we have to remember is, and I say it's in a sweeping sort of statement, but as kitchen designers, you know, 99.9% of the food that leaves that kitchen, at one point an element has to pass across the stove. Even if it's a cold starter but has got a poached quail egg on it, where's that poached quail egg coming from? So the stove is very much, I would say, sort of the center spindle of the kitchen. And if that doesn't function right, it doesn't matter how wonderful the rest of the space is organized and systems are in place or produce coming in, that fundamentally is key to a slick operation. But at the end of the day, you know, all we do is we listen to the chef and we then interpret what the chef's thoughts are into creating a block. And it's very much a conversation between the four of us around, you know, the table. You know, there's a space for, I say in the nice sense, the consultant. There's the space for the chef. There's the space for us as the distributed dealer, as it were, in the supply chain. And then the manufacturer, because at any point we don't all understand what the requirement is of that final product that's coming out of the facility, you know, we can all miss something. So it's all about, for me, it's just about conversation. I know working with Dom over many years, you know, that's always been there.
Yeah, that's key though, isn't it, Steve? But I think so many, I hear horror stories of chefs, you know, demanding certain equipment for their kitchen because they want to go off in a certain avenue. And, you know, the time the kitchen's then, it's all been bought, paid for, installed, all your sort of side of the fence have done all the hard work, especially what's gone on over here. And then you turn up and the chef's moved on, gone somewhere else. Another guy's come in, the menu's changed, and it's not fit for purpose. It's so key to have those conversations early on. And even, I think you've been a big advocate of this, Steve, and is have the flexibility to adapt if you need to as well when you're putting your kit in. It's not just, you know, that bit of kit there. If you can adapt it or evolve it, or with the menu offering itself, that's absolutely key. And I don't think enough perhaps chefs really get that. Probably only got it probably as you get more mature and you get a bit more experience. But I think the younger chefs will just want a specific bit of kit and they're only focusing on one style of food or one menu per se, but it might evolve, it might change. You need to have the kit that can allow you to evolve with it.
Right? Definitely.
And sorry, Rad, I think it's interesting that, you know, the background story to how we all sort of end up being here today. is through that relationship of, you know, Dominic and I worked together when the refurb was done at One Aldwych 8, 9, 10 years mm-hmm. ago. You know, after that, Dominic then got involved with a project in Venezuela, which I know we'll talk about maybe a little bit, but that was in partnership with another design consultant that he'd worked with, that then got him introduced to Ali Contracts, that then got him introduced to the brands within Ali, one being Moreno, mm-hmm. and just then how we end up sort of being here today with Monica. So, you know, that's what I love about our industry, is that, you know, you can start at one point and end up at a completely different mark of it. And as I just alluded to, you know, you've obviously got that new opening coming at some point.
Yeah. That's a separate issue I'm working on, but that's good fun. But yes, that's obviously, again, where you need the trust of who you're working with. And obviously Moreno and obviously the Ali Group, somebody that can, and you could deliver probably slightly complicated projects and the other side of the world that's big enough to handle it, with the expertise and the knowledge. That's key as well. It's about trusting your partners. And as you said, that does come with, you know, relationships built up over a number of years, isn't it? It's no different to suppliers of produce in the kitchen. It's exactly the same with manufacturers and equipment. Is equally as important to build up those relationships.
Definitely,
there's no quick way of doing that. There's no
your butcher, your greengrocer, everything else. Yeah, you've had that. It's not a just go through a
no
buying catalogue and go, oh, I'm going to pick that week and change it the following week.
Okay.
Well, we're going to move on and talk about Scott Hopp, which is coming up end of February at the SCE in Glasgow. Steve, Monica, I understand you're exhibiting under the banner of Grand Cuisine and it's stand 930. So
thank you for the plug.
Yeah, exactly. Monica, you're going to be there?
I'm planning to be there.
Right.
At least for part of the time, yes.
She's Steve, always welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Why should people come to Scott Hopp, and specifically, why should they come to see you? Apart from just come to see you.
Why Scott Hopp? So for us, it's the second time of exhibiting at the show. Historically, we hadn't exhibited directly as a manufacturer's representative in the past, on the basis that we tended to concentrate our exhibition presence, I'd say, you know, in the south.
Yeah.
However, we went to the show. We have a very good, strong base in Scotland. We have a very good partner distributors up there and done some amazing projects over the years. And very much felt that we wanted to be much more front-facing in front of the clients, very much more wanting to promote, obviously, the Moreno brand and the other brand that we represent in that market. Went to the show and just had an amazing show 2 years ago. To be fair, maybe some of it was post-COVID hangover, as it were, you know, people back out there. But just found the show very engaging, very patriotic marketplace that you're working and selling to, and just really wanted to go and support it. Now, that's not to say there aren't other shows that take place in the UK, but we just felt from a marketing point of view that was the reason to be there.
Yeah.
Which we will just be showing the new M1 90 series at the show, a nice mix of modern electric induction cooking elements, but also some traditional elements, you know, some gas items, solid tops and open burners, just really to go and wave the company flag, as it were, in that market and let people know that we're there. But of course, the other thing we have to recognise is that we're in a host year. Mm-hmm. So come the end of this year, pretty much the whole of the equipment industry is heading towards Milan, which I'm very much looking forward to. And obviously, we will be out here to support, you know, Moreno and our responsibilities in the UK market at that show, which is quite ironic. This is where Dominic first came out to obviously understand the brand, 2 years ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
Okay. So, as I said, Scott Hopp, really there, you know, to wave the company flag, and Monica is more than welcome to join us. I've got a list of restaurants that we can be visiting. So that's the social
there's side. Also a really good karaoke bar in Glasgow, I know.
Oh, is there?
Is there? We'll go there. But anyway, Dominic, you know, as a leading chef, what's your thoughts on exhibitions, you know, now in the market? Do you attend any specific exhibitions? I mean, obviously you're London based, so Scott Hopp maybe isn't for you, how important are they?
I go to XL pretty much most years. I think it's good to go to. I think, as you know, times are changing. I think we mentioned before, the old days it was the only way to sort of meet the contacts and you know, look at something and get your head around it was to go to physically go to one of these shows and have a look at it. Obviously, now I think with online and stuff, much more easily accessible for the information, for the knowledge, if you like. But I think they're just good to keep going and just to keep connections going. I mean, you know, I'll turn up at one of the shows and you walk around and you bump into people.
Meet people,
and that's key. I mean, we should never lose that element of. Well, society in general, I don't know how deep you want to go, but yeah, those human connections are so important, right? And that's why I think it's probably just
which you can't really get from online.
No,
or
exactly.
Even on meetings.
Exactly. It's just good to go. And you know, sometimes you walk around and you see something that you didn't know about, and you what's that? I didn't realize that. How does that work? And again, as Steve alluded to, it might not be right for you at that moment, but who knows, in 10 years you might be in another role or different, and you jog your memory, something you've seen that might work for that particular project whatever you're working on. So I think it's key to go to them. It's just good to get out and see what's going on and just meet people, because I think that's key in our industry. Hospitality industry is about people, right, and about keeping those connections and keeping just having a coffee or a beer with someone, having a quick chat, catch up. It just, you've got to keep that alive, and you don't get that from behind a screen.
No.
Well, unless you do a Teams call.
And I think what's good, sorry, Rad, jumping in. I think what's great about, the exhibitions is that they still have the live theatres, still have the Salon Culinaires, the international competition that's not only there for, established individuals in our industry, but, the young chefs that are coming out of colleges, giving them their first exposure to, a wider marketplace, a skills event. So, I sort of sit here with sort of two hats on, as it were, with my commercial Grand Cuisine. Yes, I'd love to go to every exhibition and be there and wave a flag and have a huge stand and lots of hospitality. But, the realistics of the world we live in is you can't necessarily afford to do it, and have to be quite selective. But then with my Academy, Grand Cuisine Academy hat on, where we're very supportive of what the chef lecturers do, it's important. It is important that we're seen to be there. So although we may not be exhibiting, we'll certainly be visiting. So if you are around for coffee, I'll see you for coffee at XL a couple of weeks after.
Scott Hott.
Yes.
It's Scotland's leading showcase for food, drink, hospitality sector and tourism. As a Italian, we'll go back to it, do you see the Scottish market different to, say, England or Northern Ireland or Wales, if we talk, or even like Germany, France, Italy, Australia?
Yeah, there are differences. I'm not that familiar with the Scottish market yet, but this is also one of the reasons why I want to go there, actually.
So to develop that market.
Yeah, just to understand more about the market, because I trust then Steve's job, what he does on the field. But I understand is quite different even from the Irish market or from the English market, being more loyal, more maybe it's hard to convince at the beginning to bring the ideas of what we would like, or the information we would like to bring to the market, the advantages of the new M1. Mm-hmm. But once you gain their heart, or once they are convinced, they tend to be loyal, and this is quite interesting.
That's definitely my experience as well. There's a lot more kind of loyalty going on.
Yeah.
That's not to say that other areas aren't loyal. It's just, I just find that, once they commit, they commit.
I mean, I pick up on, my thing is always when I've looked at the market in Scotland is, when I look at it from a hospitality sector, first of all, it's got some of the most expensive hotel rooms in the UK, on the level of, what Dom's charging in central London, but in stunning locations. My only problem is that, they're inherently a 3.5 or 4 hour drive between each other. Whereas in London, they're a 5 minute jump on the tube, jump off the tube. And when you look at the produce that Scotland produces, it has the best seafood in the world, has some of the best game in the world. What I find, just as a frustrating, an interesting thing, and I'd love to know from dinner we had last night, how much of those, how many of the langoustines actually were landed, in and around Italy, but how many had actually travelled from the northwest of Scotland. So for me, I love the what Scotland is about. I love that the history that they retain, the patriotic side of life up there. And it is just an amazing place. And I'm glad that no one's sort of done the stereotypical, oh, it's all deep fried Mars bars and that's all it's about. It's no, much more than that. And having had the opportunity to work on some amazing projects in Edinburgh, in Glasgow, you know, we're just finishing a project relatively recently for a restaurant, an independent restaurateur up in Glasgow. And I'm so looking forward to two nights eating in two different restaurants that, you know, that they've put up. So, you know, you're always welcome, Matt, if you want to come, but I understand you may be elsewhere.
I'm in the US that week, I think. So I would have been there otherwise. Dominic, it's safe to say you're no stranger to winning awards. I know you won the Kate Lees Hotel Chef of the Year award. Scott Hott has got a Scottish Culinary Championship and Skills Area.
Yeah.
Are these awards important, do you think, for chefs? Are they relevant?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It's I was always encouraged when I was young at the Lanesborough to go in for them. We used to put loads of people into the competition. We had the full support of it. So I always sort of grew up with that from an early age. So I've seen firsthand the benefit that it gives. Mm-hmm. So I always encourage my team to do it. We've got a couple of youngsters going in the restaurant show this year. A couple of youngsters going into a couple of categories.
Okay.
Every year we try and put some of them in. Yeah, it just gives them, apart from the, you know, they obviously learn a new skill perhaps, because I think they've introduced the Skills Theatre was introduced a few years ago, which is a really good introduction, really good addition, I think. So, you know, for example, I had a young lad last year. I think apprentice with me for a couple of years.
Right.
I put him in for one of the categories and it was cutting a chicken for sauté. So it's quite a classical cut of chicken and done it in a set way. It's, you know, it's a skill and it's a bit of probably a lost skill. Probably majority of chefs now probably can't even do it, which is ridiculous when you say that, but that's the reality of the world we live in. So literally have half an hour to cut one chicken to this specific cut. And, you know, I made him do four or five a day, every day for like a month. You know, we're lucky I've got 150 staff to feed, so they had chicken every day, so he weren't happy, but we had a lot of chicken going. And he went away, he won a gold medal and came back buzzing, back to the hotel, he was chuffed. So that's great for him personally that, you know, he won a medal and he got some confidence. But also what he probably doesn't realise that, you know, in 15, 20 years' time, if he get asked to cut a chicken for sauté, he's got, it's, you know, it's the memory, it's memory, he knows how to do it. And if you did that, if you fit it in a fish, all these skills that we don't have the opportunity through whatever reasons, you know, at the moment, the youngsters struggle to pick up and learn, that's a good way of enforcing it. So that's one massive positive as well. But also the all the other categories, it just gives them, yeah, it gives them confidence. It gives them else to think about as well. I think sometimes, you know, I have to take a step back because my day-to-day role is so varied now. You know, I'm running around, you know, I'm hands-on one minute, I'm in a meeting the next, so it could be about, you know, anything from finances to a new project to a trip to Italy. Yeah. So my role is very varied, but some of the youngsters, they might run a section for 3 to 6 months. And we change the menu all the time, but ultimately they're going through the same motion. They're coming in. So it gives them something to think about. So I've got a really good young lad that's been with me for about 6 months, and you can tell he's hungry for more. You know, he's moved section a couple of times and he's the menu, but he wants more. So I just said to him last week, what, give me a category, what do you want to do? He's gone in for, I think, the junior duck. He's got, you know, to do a duck dish in 40 minutes. And you can see him now, it gives him more. So it gives him confidence. So absolutely, yeah. And I wish... you know, I think some chefs could be probably not. I think it's your role as a senior chef to encourage teams to your youngsters, especially. It's your job to do that, and not enough chefs do it, and that frustrates me because there's no at half time. Doesn't cost anything really.
Yeah, it's interesting to say about. Yeah,
it's just time.
I'd never thought about that. Is it focuses a young? Because as you say, working 3-6 months in a section can be, in inverted commas, boring.
Yeah.
But giving them a competition to focus on gives them that. It's a bit outside the work. Yeah. It's developing their skills.
Yeah.
It helps, you know, them with confidence and self-esteem and all that. I never really actually thought of it like that.
And also, you know, I've seen it firsthand. You know, when they come back to the hotel and they won a medal or something, you know, they've got a bronze or a suit. You know, they're buzzing, you know. And I always make sure, you know, then you've got, you know, the GM will pop down, the hotel manager, they'll pop in the kitchen, have a photo, glass of champagne, you know. It just creates a good atmosphere and positivity, and that's, you know, it just helps with that as well. So there's no downside to it. So why would you not, if you if you're in charge of a team, why would you not encourage them to go in for these competitions?
Okay. Well, Scott Hotter is on the 26th, 27th of February. It's at the SEC at Glasgow, Scotland. And you can find out more at scotthot.co.uk. So go along, see Steve. Hopefully the lovely Monica will be there as well. So that brings us to the end of the show. Dominic, Monica, Steve, thank you for being part of the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us. Being here.
Thank you for being
loved it. Thanks.
Yeah, well, I've loved it. It's been great. It's been a really nice one. Great to meet you, Dominic,
and you, thanks for, as well. And thanks for the invite and thanks for hosting us, Monica.
You're welcome.
So on the next episode, I'm heading across the pond and we'll be at NAF FM and we've got a spectacular show lined up on the show floor in Atlanta. As we go on to season two, we've got more things coming up. And so far, I think we've done a different country for every episode. So we're on a roll. Thank you for listening. If you've got any questions, email me at radford@kitchencuriosity.co.uk. Any thoughts, let me know. I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.
Kitchen Curiosity is written and hosted by Radford Chancellor and is edited and produced by Tom Anderson. Kitchen Curiosity is exclusively sponsored by Ali Group and is a Sound Rebel production.